We've heard one version of the facts. We've heard the government's version. And in a situation like this, in a white-collar case, you have to remember that there are two sides to the story.
The man accused in a huge federal bribery case will stay in jail. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a look at the economic impact of the permanent fund dividend.
There's no doubt that retail sales go up at that time, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the overall budgets change that much.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
Jeffrey Hout, age 47 of Bethel, and Harry Williams, age 33 of Queethluck, were found guilty today of second-degree murder of 19-year-old Benjamin Kaiser of Hooper Bay. The jury turned in their verdict this morning. The jury also found both men guilty of kidnapping. Hout was additionally found guilty of tampering with physical evidence, but Williams was found not guilty on that charge. The jury found both men not guilty of murder in the first degree. The men accused in a massive government contracting bribery case involving EAC Native Corporation subsidiary EAC Tech are staying behind bars, three of them until trial and the fourth at least through the weekend. At a hearing in Washington, D.C. today, the lawyer for EAC Tech executive Harold Babb asked for a few more days before making his argument as to why Babb should be released on bail. Attorney Jeffrey Jacobovitz told Magistrate Judge Deborah Robinson that he'd just gotten the case and had only spoken to Babb for the first time this morning. She scheduled a hearing for Tuesday and kept Babb in jail for now. Jacobovitz made a brief statement to reporters outside the courthouse.
We've heard one version of the facts. We've heard the government's version. The proof is sitting in their hands, and in a situation like this, in a white-collar case, you have to remember that there are two sides to the story, and you have to evaluate the facts carefully after hearing both sides of the story. And my client intends to fight this case vigorously.
The three other men charged in the contracting scandal will be in detention until their trial. Army Corps of Engineers employee Kerry Kahn did not even ask to be released and waived his right to a detention hearing. His son Lee Kahn and Army Corps employee Michael Alexander did ask to be freed with restrictions. But Magistrate Judge Robinson said no, because they're too great a flight risk. She also ruled that Lee Kahn is a danger to the community because the government has recordings of him threatening to kill his brother if he told authorities about the scheme. Prosecutors say all the men faced decades behind bars, so have reason to try and flee, and said the defendants have dirt on other contractors who have not been charged and who might be motivated to help the men escape to keep them quiet. The four men were guarded by U.S. Marshals and wore orange jumpsuits. Their feet were shackled, so they had to shuffle into the courtroom. Harold Babb occasionally put his head on his hands as the proceedings went on. The state is sending out nearly $650,000 permanent fund dividends today. It's the 30th dividend paid to Alaskans. In all that time, there have been very few studies on how Alaskans spend the extra cash and how that spending affects the state's economy. But retailers say their sales around dividend time take a big jump. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
It's hard to avoid the PFD-targeted ads this time of year. Car dealers, furniture stores, even Petco wants a piece of your check. It's safe to say the PFD payout has a big impact on Alaska's economy each fall, but getting into more specifics on the matter, that is difficult.
No one has ever really looked at, you know, with any grand detail, how is the permanent fund spent?
Neil Freed is an economist with the state of Alaska.
But it's sort of surprising, especially early on, and being such a unique thing that, you know, there hasn't been half a dozen PhD theses done on it.
Freed does have theories, though. He thinks the effect of the PFD has become muted over time as receiving the yearly payout has become more routine. It's not the windfall that it used to be.
I'm sure the way we treat that permanent fund is very different today than it was when you know, we got our first permanent fund or the first four or five permanent funds. And I suspect someone who's been getting it for years behaves differently than someone who just got theirs, their first one this year or last year.
One of the few studies that has been done on the PFD backs up Fried's theory. A Rutgers University study from the 1990s showed Alaskans treat the PFD like regular income. But Juno Consulting economist Greg Erickson says the issue is far from settled. Erickson says sales tax receipts from around the state do show a jump in retail sales in October.
There's no doubt that retail sales go up at that time. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the overall budgets change that much.
Buddy Bailey with Bailey's Furniture in Anchorage says his store records a big jump in sales around PFD time. He says in years when the checks are especially big and the economy is strong, his store can see a 40% increase in sales. And he says even an average PFD sales bump is pretty good.
A pretty realistic number is probably around the 20 to 25%. And I'll bet you that's pretty uniform across most of the industries in Alaska for retail, for sure.
The checks make the biggest difference for Alaskans with the lowest incomes. Average income is lower in rural Alaska, and Buddy Bailey says that's where a lot of his October sales come from.
You know, we get a lot of phone calls from rural Alaska once dividend gets hit, once those checks hit their banks, and you know, we do a lot of ship outs. We do that every year, and that's always a big part of our business is getting furniture out to rural Alaska.
Economist Greg Erickson says while retail spending jumps, the foreclosure rate goes down. He says Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has many years of monthly data that shows the same dip in the fall year after year.
There's a down blip in October and November. People who have been behind on their mortgage payments get caught up.
Erickson is helping write a book that looks at whether the permanent fund dividend can be a model for other countries. He says the effect of the PFD goes far beyond the extra cash every Alaskan has each fall. He says Alaska is the only state where the gap between the rich and poor hasn't widened since the 1980s.
Alaska is the only state that's bucked that trend, and it's because we give a tiny share, really a small share, of the resource riches that nature provided us in Alaska. We divide that very small share equally among all Alaskans.
But on the downside, Erickson says the PFD checks increase very slightly the death rate in Alaska. That's according to a study by the National Bureau of Economic Research. He says that's because mortality goes up when people have more money in their pockets, presumably because they go out more. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
In rural Alaska, dividend checks do more than pay for new sofas. Mira Kohler is the president and CEO of the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, or AVEC. Kohler says many people in the villages prepay their winter electric bills with their PFD. She says the day checks get deposited is the busiest day of the year for AVEC.
Last year, for example, PFD Day was October 7th, and we took 387 phone calls and $106,000 in credit card payments. That's about 20 times our average day.
She says it's not so much people getting caught up as it is paying forward.
We actually have some folks that pay enough to carry them all the way up until the next PFD.
She says with the high cost of energy and other expenses in remote communities, the impact in rural Alaska of the permanent fund dividend is large. She says the cash influx it represents is a significant percentage of the disposable income in village households.
And because it comes, you know, all at one time, in the sense that, you know, if they were getting $100 a month, it wouldn't have as much impact. But if they're getting $1,100 or $1,200 in one fell swoop, that's meaningful money.
Kohler says she thinks the cash value for rural Alaska is quite a bit higher than for the average urban Alaskan. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Juneau activist isn't giving up on the idea of taxing plastic bags in the city.
Plastic bags are either banned or taxed in two-thirds of the world.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Three killer whales, or orcas, have been spotted between the villages of Ekwok and Neustuyahok, about 60 to 70 miles, river miles, up the Nooshigak River from Dillingham. Jonathan Sharp is a teacher in Neustuyahok. After hearing about the orcas from his students, he decided to go take a look.
We saw three orcas. One was larger than the other two, and the larger one would rise, and after he'd breathe, he'd kind of grunt a little bit sometimes. They were basically just rising out of the water, just their dorsal fin, and then a few times they rose far enough to see the white spot on the front sides, and they would just very slowly rise and fall up the river, turn around, maybe go down 100 yards and turn back around and continue upstream.
That behavior has scientists from NOAA's National Marine Fisheries Service concerned. They say it's not unusual for the whales to chase fish upriver, but there's not much left to eat this late in the season, and it's rare to see the whales milling around so far upriver. They're especially concerned about a yellow film coating the whale's skin, which could be a sign of stress. Barbara Mahoney is with NOAA.
What we are doing now is we are evaluating their health. We're looking at their skin condition, how long they've been up there, you know, their respiration rates, are they surfacing at normal intervals? From the pictures, we're also sharing that with our killer whale experts at our Marine Mammal Lab in Seattle, as well as experts here in Alaska and in Canada. And then from opinions of the experts, NIMS will decide if intervention is warranted.
Mahoney says intervention might mean using Japanese okimi pipes, which make a noise to drive the whales downriver. For now, NOAA officials say they are monitoring the situation and asking people to stay at least 100 yards away from the whales. They're also reminding the public that it is illegal under the Marine Mammal Protection Act to harass whales. A Juneau-based nonprofit that aims to curb the use of plastic shopping bags in the capital city won't be deterred by voters' rejection this week of a citizens' initiative to tax those bags at certain retailers. The group's director says the measure raised awareness of the pollution and environmental damage caused by plastic bags, and members will look for ways to keep the conversation going. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Turning the Tide's director, Dixie Belcher, wasn't surprised that voters rejected the group's plastic bag tax initiative by more than 2-1.
Plastic bags are either banned or taxed in 2/3 of the world. But that has never come from a vote. It has always come from a city council or from a legislature or, you know, from the country. When it goes out to a vote, it's always voted down.
Opposition came from people who disagreed with the structure of the tax, levied only on large stores like Fred Meyer, Walmart, and Safeway, with average annual gross sales of $15 million or more over the last 5 years. Most people thought the tax would be passed on to consumers.
I mean, there's a lot of people that just plain don't want a tax. And I think that they didn't like the fact that it would just apply to 4 stores. Which really wasn't our idea. That came from the business community.
Belcher says just having the measure on the ballot raised awareness of the pollution and environmental harm caused by plastic bags, especially on oceans. Turning the Tides regularly sponsors movies and speakers on the issue and gives away free reusable bags at events around town. Belcher hopes they can build on the momentum of the campaign.
I think we're going to be talking to teachers, to school teachers, with the possibility that some children can make bags in the schools, you know, that they could take home and their families would use. We're just going to continue to do that sort of thing and also try to reach people that we haven't reached.
That includes public officials and the business community.
There are definitely people in the business community that are 100% behind it. And there are definitely public officials that are interested, and I think we have some more now.
Randy Wanamaker, who was re-elected to the Assembly on Tuesday after a year-long absence, says he met a lot of people during the campaign who opposed the bag tax, but he says the same people were concerned about the city's ever-expanding landfill.
This is something that helped people talk about solid waste in the broad strategic sense.
Belcher thinks some voters who opposed the tax would have supported a ban on plastic bags. While Turning the Tides probably won't attempt another citizens initiative, she says it will continue to push for change on the grassroots level.
It's a huge problem, and I think plastic bags' days are numbered.
In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
It's been just about 2 months since the residents of Bristol Bay and Dutch Harbor have seen an issue of their community newspapers. The new owner pushed back the publication dates of the papers and announced that when they do come out, they will be combined into one newspaper. KDLG's Daisha Eaton explains.
Jason Evans, who bought the Bristol Bay Times and the Dutch Harbor Fisherman this summer, says he's combining the papers for two reasons. It was done before, and both Bristol Bay and Dutch Harbor are fishing communities.
Well, one, it was done historically, so there was a combined paper. And I know the preference is probably to have one paper for each region, Bristol Bay and Dutch, although they're very different. There's a lot of commonalities between the fishing community.
The papers were published as one newspaper about 15 years ago. The new owners, Evans and his wife, stopped publishing the Bristol Bay Times and the Dutch Harbor Fisherman during the transition. Evans bought the papers along with the Arctic Sounder on August 5th after Chelista Corporation liquidated their weekly newspaper chain, Alaska Newspapers Incorporated. Several editions of the Arctic Sounder, which serves the Barrow Arctic Slope and Northwest Arctic regions around Kotzebue, have already come out. But the Bristol Bay Times and the Dutch Harbor Fishermen have been slower to come together. And the transition, Evans explains, has been more difficult than he anticipated.
When ANI decided to just shut their doors and not necessarily work with anyone on a transition, it became very difficult for all of the new owners to get staffed and get their own office and office procedures set up to produce these papers and make sure that they reach out to customers and correctly bill them and all the things it takes to run a newspaper. I mean, we're still having people find us after a month and a half saying we would have advertised in the Arctic Sounder had we known you existed.
Evans says he's in the process of hiring two reporters for the combined paper.
Our plan is that we would have a person dedicated to kind of each region we serve. We'd want someone that understands rural Alaska and then, you know, good writing and good connections to the community if possible.
Evans says the combined version of the Bristol Bay Dutch Harbor paper is expected to be out by the end of October. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The state and ConocoPhillips are getting federal support for drilling plans in the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, or NPRA. ConocoPhillips has several leases in the area, but has so far been blocked from developing them by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers refusing to allow the construction of a bridge over the Colville River. The Department of Interior is now in the mix, supporting access to the area the Corps first made inaccessible. Adam Fetcher is a spokesman with the department.
The department is moving forward on several fronts to safely and responsibly develop Alaska's energy resources.
A group of Alaska Democrats has been lobbying for Interior support since February, when 14 of their party's legislators wrote the department saying oil from the reserve is crucial to the long-term future of the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Anchorage Representative Les Guerra was among that group. He says their work has gotten the needed results at Interior, but he says there is still work to be done.
Department of the Interior has announced that they support a bridge. So the Obama administration supports a bridge. The Department of the Interior, through him, supports a bridge. But there's the Army Corps gets to make the bureaucratic decision, and they've always been, whether under Republican or Democratic administrations, a pretty bureaucratic agency. So we're waiting for them to hopefully change their decision.
The area in which ConocoPhillips plans to drill is called the CD5 area. It's just across the Colville River, west of Conoco's existing development in the Alpine Field. A Canadian mining company is hoping to develop a major gold mine near the headwaters of a tributary of the Unic River, which flows into a canal near Ketchikan. Toronto-based Seabridge Gold says the KSM deposit is one of the largest in the world, second only to the proposed Pebble Mine in western Alaska. Seabridge unveiled its development plan during a public meeting in Ketchikan last night. KRBD's Deanna Garrison has the story.
Seabridge unveiled its development plan during a public meeting in Ketchikan last night before a crowd of skeptical residents. Around 100 residents from Ketchikan, Metlakatla, and Prince of Wales Island attended the public meeting on the proposed KSM mining development. The company has been actively exploring the KSM site since 2006. Based on that exploration, the company estimates the KSM resource at 38.5 million ounces of gold and 10 billion pounds of copper. At today's prices, the gold deposit alone would be worth $75 billion. Seabridge Environment and Sustainability Manager Brent Murphy.
We are proposing 120,000-ton-day open-pit mining operation with a mine life of 52 years.
The open pit would be located about 20 miles from the British Columbia border with Alaska, within the headwaters of the Sulphurous Creek, which is a tributary of the 80-mile-long Unic River. The Unic flows through the Misty Fjords National Monument and into Burroughs Bay in Beam Canal. Murphy says Seabridge is aware the proposed mining operation might meet some resistance on this side of the border.
We do understand that because the Unic River, of which the KSM project does reside on the Unic River drainage, there are some concerns here. So we wanted to come here and to update you folks on our project, where we're at, and answer the questions.
Murphy took the audience through the company's development plan for KSM, which includes construction of three dams for water storage, tailing storage, and seepage collection. He says a tailings dam would be more than 700 feet by the time the mining operation shuts down. The Unic has been a popular recreation area for residents in southern southeast and a significant subsistence destination for Alaskan natives. Resident Tom Lang Sr. questioned what, if anything, Alaskans could do if the company didn't meet its environmental obligations, since the mine would be located in Canada.
Our people have been living here for 10,000 years. You've been talking about 2008 like it's a big deal. It's a real big deal to all the natives here, and we want to know. For thousands of years, we lived on all these drainages, that they'll be protected.
Seabricks Murphy says a company would not be allowed to continue operating if it failed to meet Canada's water quality laws, which he says are similar to those in the U.S. Faye says the KSM project is just one of 20 under exploration on the Stikine, Iskut, Unic, and Nass watersheds in Canada. Alaska Department of Natural Resources officials attended Wednesday night's meeting. DNR Large Mine Coordinator Jack DeMarchu says he visited the site a couple of weeks ago.
In terms of how they're proposing to build the mine, like the designs of their dams, or the fact that it's an open pit, and how they may be storing their water or their waste rock, those are things that are very similar to the way we do it here in Alaska.
DeMarchi says the state will not issue any permits for the project, but that Alaska will be part of the discussion since the Rivers Treaty effectively invites the U.S. to be part of the process. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Southeast Alaska's commercial dive fishing seasons are underway this month for red sea urchins, sea cucumbers, and geoduck clams. The dive fisheries continue to see impacts from the region's expanding population of sea otters. KFSK's Joe Viknicki reports.
Diving for sea cucumbers opened up Monday, October 3rd. The fishery has openings every week, typically lasting a day and a half. The cucumber fishery usually lasts for several weeks. These slow-moving, bottom-feeding sea creatures are shaped like their vegetable namesake, and they're sold in Asian markets. The industry is expecting they'll fetch a higher price at the docks this year. Phil Doherty is executive director of the Southeast Alaska Regional Dive Fisheries Association.
We anticipate the price being very good this year. We're hopefully the divers are anticipating somewhere around $4, $4.50 a pound. To start the season off with, the last couple years, the price has been between $2.50 and $3.50 a pound. So the market looks really good for sea cucumbers.
Typically, about 140 to 150 divers participate in the sea cucumber fishery. Fish and Game is keeping a couple acute areas closed to harvest this year because of a growing population of sea otters eating too many of the creatures in those areas. They include Sea Otter Sound on northwest Prince of Wales Island, along with another area south of Sitka Sound. Fish and Game's Hebert says sea otter predation is a continuing problem for the dive fisheries.
We've seen substantial evidence of sea otter predation during the surveys, particularly out on the outer coast areas, outside of Prince of Wales Island and Sitka Sound area and outer Baranof. So that continues to be a pretty serious threat to the populations of sea urchins and gooey ducks and sea cucumbers, and also the commercial fisheries for those.
Seasons for gooey duck clams and red sea urchins also open up this month. The guideline harvest level for urchins is just under 3.3 million pounds this year. That's down substantially from last year's GHL of around 5 million pounds, due mainly to otter predation. Gonads of the spiky sea creatures are a delicacy in Asian markets, but the Alaskan product in recent years has not been competitive overseas. And as a result, participation in the urchin fishery is down to just a couple divers in the region, and the department does not expect those divers to come close to catching this year's GHL. That's not the case with gooey ducks, a large clam prized in overseas markets. Like cucumbers, gooey ducks may also bring divers a higher price this year. Sardfa's Doherty thinks the clams could get around $8 a pound, up from the past several years.
Here's what the market in Hong Kong has picked up for gooey ducks. Our product coming out of Southeast Alaska is very well accepted on the market. We have good quality gooey duck clams coming out of Southeast, but the Washington State fisheries this summer, and along with the BC fisheries, was very strong for ex-vessel value, and we're anticipating that carrying over to our season.
The GHL for the region is over 557,000 pounds of gooey duck clams. Fish and Game determines weekly openings of various areas around the region based on results of testing clam samples for paralytic shellfish poisoning conducted by the state's Department of Environmental Conservation. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Dillingham, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, and Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits, from research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine.
And by
Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com. October is Alaska Energy Awareness Month, a time to focus on what we're doing to meet Alaska's energy needs and reduce consumption in our everyday lives. For more information, go to akenergyefficiency.org. Energy efficiency in Alaska, it's common sense. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.